From the Sky News Centre at 5. 12 British banks and building societies have had their credit ratings slashed. The move by ratings agency Moody's could leave those financial institutions facing higher borrowing costs. Meanwhile, a leading economist is dismissing claims from the Bank of England's governor that we're living in the worst economic crisis ever. Andrew Hilton worked at the World Bank and says we're not living in the 30s.
I wonder what got into him when he said that. I mean, he only has to look outside the window. In the 1930s, there were people lined up on Jarrow marches. It's not the same thing at all. I think these are exciting times to be a central banker, and perhaps the excitement went to his head.
A mum who left her two young children in an unlocked car at night while she went drinking in Manchester has been given a four-month suspended prison sentence. 21-year-old Kayleigh McNaughton's nine-month-old baby was strapped in a car seat while her three-year-old was in the passenger well. The Health Protection Agency is investigating a cluster of cases of Legionnaire's disease in people who have been to Corfu. The organisation says it's aware of nine cases of the disease in people who have travelled to different areas of the Greek islands since August. Ed Miliband has used a reshuffle to give a youthful look to his shadow cabinet. Jaka Emuna is now shadow business secretary and Rachel Reeves is shadow chief secretary to the Treasury. The Labour leader is pleased with his new team.
Well, I think we have people who are ready to serve in our shadow cabinet, and they're going to work with people with experience who've been in Parliament longer. And I think that's the right combination of youth and experience. It is a changing of the guard for Labour, but I think it's important to bring on that new talent.
England can seal their place in the finals of Euro 2012 tonight with a draw in Montenegro. Elsewhere, Wales face Switzerland, Northern Ireland face Estonia, and the Republic of Ireland are against Andorra. And James Bond star Daniel Craig is to become the latest star to film in Scotland. The actor is to shoot the final parts of the 007 movie in Argyll. That's the latest. I'm Kelly Withers.
BCFM 93.2 is a charity and works with the diverse communities in Bristol. So please continue to support us by getting involved and spreading the word.
Bristol's favourite soul institution, the Soul Train, is back on air this Sunday on BCFM 93.2. Check us out and tune in 7pm to 9pm for the finest in soul and jazz funk.
You can listen to BCFM live on the internet and also download every show as a podcast at bcfm.org.uk. BCFM is the award-winning community radio station for Bristol and is here to give everybody in Bristol a voice. BCFM 93.2. Bristol is our community.
Hello Bristol and welcome to BCFM's Politics Show, Friday Drive Time. I'm Tony Gosling, and hopefully on his way here, at least he's supposed to be here anyway, is Gary Hopkins. That's Lib Dem councillor for Knowle and Cabinet Executive Member for Waste. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. After the 6 o'clock news, the biggest changes in 60 years to who is and who isn't allowed to build in the countryside, freeing land for developers. But will we see massive shoebox housing estates, or eco-villages, or even just nuclear power stations? Mike Birkin's here from Southwest Friends of the Earth to explain who will and will not be able to build. Plus, postponed from last week, the murder 10 years ago of nationalist journalist Martin O'Hagan in Northern Ireland, and revelations in last week's Guardian that his killers were working closely with and being protected by the British security services. And the euro crisis has been kicked out this week, but so long as the finance ministers fail to act, it will be back. We hear from former bank boss Michael Hudson about how the crash is being orchestrated by any real debate being closed down by euro finance ministers. And zombie banking. Just like other corporations, banks are legally people. So if they really are bust, as many believe, what does it mean to have dead banks stalking the streets of London? We look back 30 years ago to the failure of Banco Ambrosiana and the discovery of its boss Roberto Calvi dead, hanging underneath Blackfriars Bridge. What are the lessons from Calvi's murder and that banking collapse and fraud? What might we learn for today? That's in the second hour after six. On to our news review in a minute, but first, Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, lows of 9 degrees Celsius and dry. This weekend, highs of 16 Celsius, fairly cloudy with some sunny spells and gusty winds. Next week, highs of 16 Celsius, fairly cloudy but dry week with some sunny spells next week. Next weekend, that's the 15th and 16th of October, highs of 16 Celsius, again with sunny spells. So not too much rain, isn't it? That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Time to introduce this week's guests now, and Gary Hopkins, who's the Lib Dem executive member for Waste on the City Council and the Council for Knoll, is due in any time. He hasn't arrived yet, so we'll let you know as soon as he gets here. But let's have a chat first with Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers. Now, first of all, Martin, let's have a chat a little bit more personal than usual, because you had a bit of a run-in with the bank yourself this week, haven't you?
Yeah, my cash card stopped functioning. I think it's some kind of electronic problem with the card. So I went down to the branch, the co-op branch in the centre of town this morning, and I'm going to have to get a new card, basically, but it's rather inconvenient.
But it makes you realise just how dependent we are on these little microchips, doesn't it?
It does, and of course, what could happen in a banking crash is that all ATMs will stop functioning. That may happen quickly in places like Greece, or more slowly in places like Britain, but that's certainly what happened in Argentina.
This is back in 2001. Yeah. What exactly happened in Argentina?
Well, there's something called the Corralito, which basically meant that the banks just shut their doors. And people said, but my money's in there. And they said, sorry, we've lost it. People think that this can't happen. It can happen. It does happen. And it probably will happen.
OK, so also we've had this massive thing of quantitative easing, £75 billion, what they call wonderfully QE2. Quantitative easing, first of all, just start from scratch. Can you explain what is this quantitative easing? It's just like printing money, is it?
Effectively, yes. It's putting more liquidity into the system. Basically, the government buys gilts from the banks, which puts more cash in their hands, and they could, in theory, lend it out, although I suspect that they won't, because there's no reason why they should. This kind of money printing, or even reducing interest rates, is what Keynes used to characterise as pushing on a string. It won't make any effect on the economy because the economy is falling down a hole. And at those circumstances, people don't want to borrow money under any circumstances. So making it cheap and making more of it available doesn't do any good. It's basically what Keynes called a liquidity trap. And the economy is now in a classic Keynesian liquidity trap.
Now, it might sound obvious, but if you're going to spend £750 billion that Mervyn King has announced he's going to be spending into the economy, why is that money going into the banks? And why doesn't it just go into our bank accounts for us to spend and get the economy going?
Yes,
because
exactly.
If it did go into our bank accounts, every single person, including children in the UK, would get £1,250 per person.
Yeah, but what would happen then? I mean, what would happen for me if I got that money is it would cancel some of my debt.
Well, isn't that exactly what Mr Cameron was asking for in his conference speech
this
week?
Yes, indeed. But I mean, the point is that what they should be doing is concentrating, pushing resources towards the bottom end of society so that people are kept afloat and they have money to spend and the economy keeps growing. But what they're doing instead, everything they've been doing all along, is simply to rescue the financial system. The financial system was obviously rescued in 2008, and they've been carrying. And during that period that we've had since 2008, they should have been getting on with rebuilding the economy. But of course, what they've done is they've gone back to doing what they did before, which is speculative investments. A lot of quantitative easing goes into commodity speculation, which forces up prices like oil and food, which actually makes the economy contract. So this is not going to work. It's an act of desperation. So at the same time as the government insists that it's sticking to its cuts programme, it's printing funny money to make up for the fact that there's not enough demand in the economy. This is totally silly. They should stop the cuts programme if they're worried about demand in the economy, not print funny money.
So that £750 billion, I'm afraid the people of Britain can't have it. It's got to go to the banks, has it? Or
indeed.
Could we not have a bit of both?
No. Well, you could, in theory. You could actually cut people's tax rates at the bottom if you wanted to, like cutting cut VAT, for example. But that would be real money, and then they would be saying, oh, actually, what we're doing... I mean, Osborne was talking about creating a new credit facility for small businesses, but then it was politely pointed out to him that wouldn't be cutting public expenditure, that would be increasing it, so he was forced to back off. The government is caught in a cleft of its own making by insisting that it's going to make cuts. The economy then splutters and looks as if it's going to die. They then say, well, let's just put some more petrol in the tank. But the machine itself is not functioning because you've basically stuck a great big brick in the mechanism, and putting more petrol in it won't make it go.
Well, King Mervyn, as I love to call him, he's in his talk to Sky News yesterday. He was approached by Sky and asked about quantitative easing, about printing money, and they put a very good point to him, which is that in the Weimar Republic in Zimbabwe, this was a disaster. So let's have a little listen to that clip right now.
Okay. These are the kind of policies which in some ways have been tried out in countries like Zimbabwe and the Weimar Republic in Germany. How can we be sure that that's not the same path that we're heading towards in the UK?
Very simply, because what happened in the Weimar Republic and in Zimbabwe was that the amount of money that was created grew at thousands and hundreds of thousands of percent a year. It's not growing by thousands of a percent a year, it's actually fallen. And if we can get back to our underlying growth rate of somewhere around 5 or 6%, we should be able to maintain steady growth with low inflation.
That was Mervyn King speaking yesterday to Sky News. Martin, what did you think of what he had to say there?
Well, in a sense, he's right. I mean, the amount of money they're chucking at this is nothing like what we're talking in Weimar Germany or Zimbabwe. So it's a much more moderate amount of money. But by that token, also, it's not really going to have much of an effect. The Federal Reserve is not doing any more quantitative easing because of the influence of the Tea Party, I suppose. And therefore, it's not actually moved the markets one way or the other. I mean, there's been a big yawn, is the response of the markets to this announcement by the British.
Well, I don't know about you, but I'm fed up with everybody saying, oh, this isn't going to work, that isn't going to work. What is going to work, and what should happen tomorrow to get this economy moving?
First of all, people have got to accept that the private banking system is kaput. We've been living in a fool's paradise for the last 4 years, or perhaps a fool's Hades.
So we're in denial, you're saying?
Yes, we are. I mean, basically, the banks are bust, the banking system is bust. Now, what we need is political leadership that turns to the people and says, look, the banking system's bust, we're going to have to start again from scratch. That means, effectively, that private banking is finished, and that, basically, the wealthiest section of the society in Britain and the US and elsewhere is going to have to lose a lot of money. Now, They were the ones who made the bad bets. They ought to lose their money. Under a full-on free market system, the state wouldn't have stepped in to bail the banks out in 2008. They would have lost their money. That would have been catastrophic for the rest of the economy, so there was a case for the government to step in and bail the banks out to stop that happening. But as soon as they'd done that, the governments of the world should have basically said, right, we're the masters now, we're going to do it like this, this and this. But they didn't, because there was no political preparation. The political class in charge in Britain and the US and Europe had no will or experience or understanding that they would have to do this. They were like somebody who was suddenly presented with a three-month-old baby by the pretty chambermaid, and they said, where did that come from? Because they'd not had any thought at all that the banking system could collapse. Now, I understand that politicians are not necessarily the sharpest tools in the box, but the civil servants could and should have known that the banking system would collapse, and they should have had a plan ready to go. But even with a plan ready to go, you've got to have a mass movement to do the right thing, because the political power of the financial oligarchy is enormous and has got greater during the crisis. The people at the top are actually wealthier now than they were at the beginning of the crisis, and they're in a position to hold a gun to the head of the politicians and say, if you don't do this and you don't do that, we will collapse. So therefore, you've got to keep bailing us out. Now, and this is the argument against bailing out failing industries. They keep coming back for more. They never get themselves straightened out, and that's the case, for example, for cutting subsidies in industries like aviation, mining, car manufacture. And the same case would hold for banking, except that they've made themselves, you know, like a tapeworm, they've made themselves indispensable to our biology. I mean, so they keep eating our stuff.
I rather like this expression, zombie banks, because the whole concept of the corporation being legally a person, and we're going to be talking about that in part two. But now let's have a listen, really, to Mervyn King rounding up what exactly he is doing while he's quantitative easing, which was another question asked to him yesterday by Sky News.
Couldn't you have come up with a better name than quantitative easing? I mean, it sounds like a medical ailment, to be honest.
Yes, I have never used the phrase. that you just expressed, and I won't. It's asset purchases. But I prefer it very simply to be, are we injecting more money into the economy or are we taking money out? And that's, of course, exactly what we do when we change interest rates. This is very similar to a change in interest rates. We tighten monetary policy, we ease monetary policy. When we tighten monetary policy, we take money out of the economy. When we ease monetary policy, we put more money in. These things can be reversed when it's appropriate according to the state of the economy. That's why monetary policy is the right policy to deal with present circumstances.
That's King Mervyn there, Mervyn King, speaking yesterday to Sky News. What about what he was saying there, Martin? Actually, the whole thing is very simple. When you're in financial difficulty, you ease the money supply. What he's doing is simply easing it. You know, other times you might have to tighten it, but this time he's easing it.
He is, and it comes back to what I was saying earlier about a liquidity trap. They're pushing on a string. Nobody wants to borrow money at this moment. Individuals, companies.
Well, companies,
are in debt.
Small companies particularly do.
No, they don't really. The problem is that there's no demand in the economy, and interest rates are already just about zero, and quantitative easing just means that there's more money available at just about zero interest rates, but nobody's borrowing because everybody's terrified of what is coming over the
but
horizon.
But we keep hearing that small businesses can't borrow, even if they,
yes,
have, they want to do
that may
stuff.
Be so, because there's a bias in the system towards big lenders. There always was. If you think of it, if you're a retail banker, it's much easier to make a big loan to one person because the admin costs on that are much lower. Lots of small loans to lots of little fiddly people is actually quite expensive to administer. Which is why there's always a bias in favour of lending big to big people who've got assets which you can lend against. And that's a perennial problem, and it's always been a problem and continue to be so. But just think, it's not a time. If I was a banker running at a local bank around here, I wouldn't be saying to people at this moment, this is the time to open a business unless they've got a really, really good business plan.
Or to expand your business, maybe, well, because other businesses are failing. So well, yeah, there are openings
yes,
in the market.
The demand, it's the whole thing functions as a great big hole. You can't just expand demand for small business products in a situation where the economy is tanking. It's just infeasible. And ultimately, we knew about all of this 50 years ago. It's Keynes's classic liquidity trap. The only way to break a liquidity trap is for the government to invest in all of the things that we would like to do. And by doing that, the government, the private sector is too scared to invest. So the government has to bite the bullet and invest. And they can either borrow the money at 0% interest from the money markets, so all this stuff about how we can't afford to borrow any more money, interest rates are as low as they've ever been. And of course, this quantitative easing, of course, could be used just to keep some of the thing going that which are being cut. So the government's having schizophrenia here. With one hand, they're taking money out of the economy by cutting public expenditure, and with the other hand, they're throwing a few crumbs back in and hoping that will make a difference.
So these few
it's
crumbs,
totally contradictory,
these few crumbs,
and shows what a mess they're in.
These few crumbs is actually £750 billion. Is that actually going to trickle down to the economy from the banks,
no.
Or is it just going to be
no,
used as?
No, it's probably going to be spent on commodity speculation in international markets by the banks
to keep the banks solvent.
Well, just basically they will use it. They're not solvent anyway, but they will, because all of the on their books there are all of these this is why they're zombie banks. On their books are all of these derivatives and collateralized debt obligations and so on, which are actually worth only a third of what they claim to be worth, possibly nothing. And if they were forced to mark to market, that is proper accounting procedures, all the banks would be bust. So we're all going through all of this rigmarole to keep up the pretense that they are not bust.
Okay.
Because they are so indispensable that we couldn't do without them.
Now we've heard
of course
that
we could easily do without them.
Martin, we've heard that Lib Deb councillor for Knoll and executive member for Waste, Gary Hopkins, is in the traffic on the way here, so we'll be having him here in a minute. But before, when did money stop being there to help us trade, a simple, you know, aid to exchange, and start running our lives?
It's always had a number of functions, hasn't it? It's not just it's there to settle bills. It's a store of value. It performs a number of functions. The big change was when the Bretton Woods system was dismantled in 1971 by Nixon, who decided to take the dollar off gold. Now, at that point, the US was in a position to print as many dollars as it liked. And when we're talking about Zimbabwe printing money, the people who've really printed money in the last 30, 40 years are the United States of America. And there is a massive, massive dollar overhang.
Yeah, but you haven't had runaway inflation,
no.
Hyperinflation in the US,
no,
like you had
in
Zimbabwe.
You will when the dollar collapses, because everybody will sell the dollar and those dollars will all end up inside the US. so that as the US economy collapses, hyperinflation will kick in.
Now, one of the things that
with the quantitative
one of the things that worries me about all this is you've got a lot of these stock trading and currency trading systems are now computerized and automatic. So I would imagine once a run starts, the computers will pick it up, and within seconds, the whole thing could go down.
That's right. It will all happen in an afternoon, and people will go, "Why? Wow, can it just happen like that?" And the answer is yes, it can, and it will, for sure.
Okay, well, we'll be talking more, as I said, about the zombie banks after 6 o'clock. But for now, we've had the Conservative Party conference this week, and let's have a listen now to some little clips from George Osborne's speech, the Chancellor's speech. And here he talks about the three big human mistakes that he's identified that have been made that have brought about the present financial crisis.
Our economic problems were not visited on this country by some cruel act of God or blind force of nature. They were created by the mistakes of human beings. And the endeavour of human beings can put them right. What were those mistakes? There were three of them. And they were all connected with each other. First, the last government borrowed too much money. They thought you could borrow without regard to ability to pay, spend without regard for value for money, all on the premise that boom would never end in bust. They saddled the country with the worst debt crisis in our history. What a catastrophic mistake. Let us make sure it never happens again. Economic advisor to Gordon Brown. I'm not sure I'd put that on my CV if I was Ed Balls. It's like personal trainer to Eric Pickles. Although I have to say, when it comes to chasing down council waste, no one runs faster than our Eric. The second mistake was made by banks who ran up staggering debts of their own, buying financial instruments even they couldn't understand. The banks and those regulating them believed that the bubble would never stop growing, that the markets were always self-correcting, that greed was always good, that their Ponzi schemes would never collapse, that none of the debts would ever turn bad. And the message from this hall is clear. They let down their customers, they let down their shareholders, and they let down this country. And there was a third mistake. Our European neighbours plunged headlong into the euro without thinking through the consequences. How could they believe that countries like Germany and Greece could share the same currency when they had vastly different economies and no mechanism to adjust? For generations to come, people will say, "Thank God Britain didn't join the euro."
That was George Osborne there, and his three reasons that the economy is in the state it is. First of all, Martin, what's your take on his take on what he was saying there? Okay, certainly I would imagine you'd agree with point number two, that the banks have made a mess.
Yes, I think that's true, but of course it was not that long ago that George Osborne was holding up Ireland as an example of what we all should do, which is deregulate the banks and cut corporation tax. So he was very much one of those people that thought that the bubble would never burst and all the rest of it. So I'm glad he's seen the light now, but it's a bit better late than never, eh? The borrow and spend one, which is about government expenditure. The main reason why government expenditure or government debts have gone up is a result of the collapse of the banks. So that comes back to point number two. And the euro, I think the euro, he's got a point. The euro was badly conceived. It's now in trouble. But I don't think there's much room for Britain to get complacent, because if the eurozone collapses, as it looks as if it may, our banks will go down with it. So there's nothing to be happy about there.
Now, we're also joined by a Lib Dem councillor for Knoll and executive member for Waste, Gary Hopkins. Hi, Gary. Welcome to Drive Time. Glad you make it. Now, what about what you've just been hearing from George Osborne and his speech there? Were you convinced?
Well, I'm never convinced by George Osborne, no. But having said that, I mean, the last government did make some horrible errors in terms of financial planning, and some of the financial instruments that were allowed and some of the dodgy practices were absolutely appalling. But then again, I seem to remember that the Conservative Party were actually supporting Labour government policy and endorsing it all the way through. And it was only a certain Mr. Cable who was actually warning people about the debt crisis and personal debts, and this is all going to end in tears. With regard to the euro, well, frankly, the concept was fine. The trouble is that all the rules were bent at the last minute for political reasons to allow countries in who weren't ready and didn't actually qualify. And if they'd stuck to the rules properly and allowed only the countries in that had proper, stable economies and could manage their money, then the Eurozone would not be in the problems it's in now.
Now, another analogy that George Osborne used a little bit further on in his speech was about the banks being part of a sort of car, and you're pressing the accelerator down in the bank at the gearbox, even though he used the word transmission, which is a sort of American version of what a gearbox is. I don't know if it was an American that wrote his speech for him, but anyway, let's have a listen to that now. George Osborne's car analogy on the economy.
Keeping interest rates as low as possible, for as long as possible, is crucial for dealing with the debt crisis. It's the first part of our plan. But because banks are damaged, they won't lend at the current low rates. It's like putting your foot on the accelerator, but because the transmission mechanism isn't working properly, the car wheels don't respond. So this is the second part of our plan. We've got to get credit flowing in our economy.
George is talking about credit, Martin, there as a sort of fuel in the car. Is he right?
Well, the problem is effective demand in the economy. You've got, as I said before, what is a Keynesian liquidity trap. That is to say that even with quantitative easing and interest rates at virtually zero, there's nobody really wants to borrow because the future is too uncertain. And this is when the government traditionally would intervene and spend on infrastructure and so on to try and boost the economy. But of course, the resources to do that have already been sucked up by the banks who have been protected. So it's a catch-22 situation.
Well, what are your thoughts on this, Gary? Because it does seem, a lot of people now are saying, that the government actually needs to get proactive and actually start some spending rather than cutting in order to give confidence, as Martin was just saying there, to the economy.
I think it depends on the type of spending. It's absolutely true that what has actually been achieved by the coalition government is effectively a good credit rating for this country, which is particularly important and is allowing us to borrow money comparatively cheaply. And in terms of revenue spending, we have to get that under control, and it was totally out of control. On the other hand, investment into long-term projects, effectively spend to save in the long term into infrastructure projects, would be certainly a very good idea. And that's certainly something that we're looking at locally on a Bristol basis.
Where? What spending on what?
On there's a number of projects that we would like to do that we know that the public want in Bristol, and we're actually looking as to, obviously not as large a scale as central government could actually fund, but we're looking at trying to bring forward some of the capital spending there on things that people actually want.
Can you just be a bit more specific? You know,
no,
where
no.
Specific?
Because we haven't fixed our budget yet, but it's a concept that we're actually examining the detail of at the moment. And what we want to do is to boost the construction industry within Bristol, and that's because that's one area that suffered quite badly. And we actually quite a lot of small schemes, comparatively small schemes, will boost further the local economy in Bristol. We haven't suffered as badly in Bristol as a lot of other places, but certainly construction has had a squeeze on it.
I hate to disappoint you, Gary, you're talking about our credit rating, but today Moody's have downgraded the debt ratings of 12 British banks. The cost of borrowing for the affected financial institution is going to go up. So that's maybe that the British sovereign debt and the country has a reasonable credit rating, but 12 of our major banks have now been downgraded by Moody's just today.
I'm well aware of that. That relate to those private institutions on basis that they thought that the British government might allow one or two of them to actually fail, which in the long term, when there's some restructuring done within the banks, actually wouldn't be a bad thing, because that's been half the problem, that the banks were allowed to get to such a state that it would have brought down the British economy if any of them had failed. Now, what's busy happening at the moment is that the banks are being changed in the basic structure, which basically was something, again, that Vince Cable has been advocating for a very long time, that you need to split off basic banking services from the, should we say, speculative areas of the banking.
But that's been agreed, hasn't it, by the Vickers report, but it's not going to actually happen until at least another 3 or 4 years' time. I mean, is that Martin, I'll maybe ask you this, is that quick enough?
No, because I think the banking system now is so fragile that Greece is definitely going to default, partly because of the austerity policies being imposed on them by the European Central Bank, by the IMF, by the Troika, as they call it in Greece, the European Financial Stability Facility, or whatever it is. That's actually making their budget deficit worse, and austerity just does make budget deficits worse, and the markets in their saner moments realise that, which is why they're all preparing, as that trader said the other day, the market is toast. So reform of the banking system, I totally agree with, they should never have been allowed to bring these banks into the same pot anyway. A retail bank shouldn't have been allowed to be put with a casino bank, and in the past that wasn't the case. And Vince Cable has been right about a lot of things, and I agree with a lot of his speech at the Liberal Party conference. But the problem is, basically stable door, horse, bolted. The banking system is bust, comprehensively bust, and that is going to be clear before Christmas. So talking of reform is now by the by.
Well, anyway, on to David Cameron, the Prime Minister's speech at the Tory Party conference this week. And let's have a listen to what he had to say. He also used this analogy that George Osborne used as well, which was about sort of fixing the roof, the crisis in the house.
So let us reject the pessimism. Let us bring on the can-do optimism. Let us summon the energy and the appetite to fight for a better future for our country, Great Britain. This wasn't a normal recession. It was a debt crisis. It was caused by too much borrowing by individuals, banks, businesses, and most of all by governments. When you're in a debt crisis, some of the normal things that governments can do to deal with a normal recession, like borrowing to cut taxes or increasing spending, these things won't work because they lead to more debt, which would make the crisis worse. Why? Because it takes risks of higher interest rates, less confidence, and the threat of even higher taxes in future. The only way out of a debt crisis is to deal with your debts. That's why households are paying down the credit card and the store card bills. It means banks getting their books in order. And it means governments all over the world, cutting spending and living within their means. Our plan is right. Our plan will work. I know that you can't see it or feel it right now, but think of it like this. The new economy we're building, it is like building a house. The most important part is the part you can't see, the foundations. Slowly but surely, we are laying the solid foundations for a stronger future. And the vital point is this: if you don't stick with it, it won't work.
Well, that's David Cameron speaking at the Conservative Party conference earlier this week. Gary, do you agree with this house analogy? And do you think actually what's going on right now is the coalition government is building a firm foundation for a recovery?
I think the real danger is that although there is progress in some areas, there is definitely an increase in manufacturing business, which has been well overdue. I think the real danger is, are we going to be doing it quickly enough and in time? And whilst, you know, we are losing public sector jobs and creating private sector jobs, it is all a matter of balance, and confidence is a big factor. So governments are in a position at the moment, if they're damned if they do and then damned if they don't.
It's all very well him talking up the economy, but what's he actually going to do? I mean, surely the government's got to actually demonstrate that it's doing something.
Well, in actual fact, building the confidence is quite vital. And some will say that some of the words that were put around by politicians talking the economy down was actually one of the most dangerous things that actually happened. You've got to give realistic warnings and give people some hope, because in the end, if you actually keep on going on about gloom and doom, etc., you know, as Ed Balls, then basically you do as much damage as actually practice.
And not just Ed Balls, but also Martin Summers. So, Martin, is this real? People like you talking the economy down could actually be responsible for the crisis as it is.
No, I absolutely refuse to accept that. In 2008, the private banking system met its Waterloo, basically. The lies, the nonsense
that you're talking about Northern Rock and RBS and
the whole system was actually put through the mincer. And because the governments of the world intervened to prop up the banking system, people then believed that the banking system therefore was solvent and was still in existence and would somehow bounce back. Now reality kicks in. The governments run out of resources to bail out the banking system, which is why the Eurozone bailout won't work, because there isn't any more money to bail the banks out with, even if they wanted to. And also, austerity never works in this situation. Now, it's absolutely clear to me that if everybody follows the austerity road, which is exactly what people are Osborne is saying, that everybody should cut back. Governments all over the world, Cameron said there, should cut back their expenditures. Now, that means that we are guaranteed 100% a crash. 100%. It's not even at 17%. The IMF said there's a 17% chance of a crash. The IMF have been wrong about everything for 30 years. It's 100%. If everybody cuts back simultaneously, the banks will go down.
So David Cameron says we need to deal with our debt, but you disagree.
The way to deal with debt is cancel it. Not pay it, cancel it. A lot of it has just got to be cancelled. That means wealthy people will lose a lot of money.
Are you talking
one
about,
way or another, they've got to lose it.
Are you talking about the country going bankrupt and then sort of starting again?
All the time. In Latin America in the 1930s, every single country went bankrupt and refused to repudiated their debts. And everybody said, if you do that, you'll never get any more money. Blah, 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 blah. Eventually, of course, the people who wanted to invest came back because they wanted the things the Latin Americans had got, the gold, the diamonds, the oil. If ultimately, basically, unpayable debts will not be paid.
But we're going through
this rigmarole now of trying to make sure that the bondholders and the people running the stock market get every penny that they are supposedly owed. They're not going to get it. A crash is inevitable.
But Gary, I mean, what Martin's saying is surely is unthinkable, that we just don't pay our debt. I mean, that's not certainly what David Cameron was saying.
That's capitalist theory, Tony.
Gary.
There is obviously severe danger in mass default that has very, very big problems. But I think at the end of the day, what finishes up is a messy compromise. That's what nearly always happens.
It has in the past.
And basically, I think that's what we'll eventually work towards. The regulation of the banks was an absolute nightmare, and probably worse here than practically anywhere else in the world.
Yeah.
It was a complete and utter shambles.
There wasn't any.
And it really did contribute massively. But I do find it absolutely staggering for Labour politicians to be saying it's all the banks' fault, it was nothing to do with us, when quite frankly they were leading the cheers.
Well, anyway, let's move to the end of David Cameron's speech now and have a listen to that, where he's talking about dogfighting.
Remember, it's not the size of the dog in the fight, it's the size of the fight in the dog. Overcoming challenge, yes, confounding the sceptics, reinventing ourselves. That is what we do. It's called leadership. Let this time of challenge be turned into a time of opportunity. Not sitting around watching things happen and wondering why, but standing up, making things happen and asking, why not? We have the ideas, we have the people, and now we have a government that's freeing those people, backing those ideas. So let's see an optimistic future. Let us show the world some fight. Let us pull together, let us work together, and let us together lead Britain to better days ahead.
If you can hear him through the applause, Gary, what are your thoughts there about what David Cameron had to say? Is he a Robin Hood or is he a used car salesman?
Well, I mean, we've had dogfighting, no doubt it'll be bear baiting shortly. And,
isn't it illegal, dogfighting?
Sending children up chimneys, you know? I mean, quite frankly, some of the stuff is just absolute nonsense.
Yeah, I mean, I'm just reminded of David Brent in The Office. I mean, this is one of those kind of meaningless speeches about, you know, we're going to pull through and we're going to, you know... I mean, it's just got no content, has it? It's just self-referential puff.
But, I mean, he's talking about fighting it, isn't he?
Well,
it's what he's saying.
Talking about fighting. We're going to see some fighting. We are going to see some fighting. In Greece, the people are on the streets. They'll show them some dog fighting. because the government, the socialist government, is going to fall, and the conservative opposition are backing the demonstrators because they're not going to pay, and that's going to crash the British banks.
Okay, well, away from the party conference.
Talking about fighting.
Now, and the BBC is risking irreparable damage to the best journalism in the world. At least that's according to the National Union of Journalists. The cuts announcement yesterday is a direct result of the licence fee settlement clinched behind closed doors last autumn between the coalition government and the BBC management. The deal froze the licence fee until 2017 and introduced new funding responsibilities for the BBC, including World Service, S4C, BBC Monitoring, local TV and broadband. The announcement represents 20% cut over 5 years, in addition to the 7,000 jobs already lost at the BBC since 2004. Well, another example of cuts, Gary. You in favour of this one?
I think basically there was a fair amount of fat in the BBC. They do some brilliant reporting, and hopefully that will not be affected. I think there's every chance that they will come through it unscathed. But I'm not an expert on the internal politics of the BBC. I just speak to a lot of people who work in there, and quite a lot of them, being quite frank, and say, well, there's a lot of middle management posts that could actually go. And what has disappointed me about the BBC in the not-too-distant past has been the vast fees paid to some celebrities. You know, I don't pay my licence fee to have £6 million given to Jonathan Ross.
Another thing which is being cut, Martin, is the sport. What's your thoughts about the BBC cuts announced yesterday?
Well, I mean, there's been a long-term agenda by people like Rupert Murdoch to get the BBC out of the game, because from their point of view, the BBC is like a rock in their throat.
They've actually partially pared back their website, and as a response to Rupert Murdoch saying it's unfair competition.
Yeah. I think the answer to that is break Rupert Murdoch's legs and send him to prison, and then the BBC can take over the whole lot, eh?
Well, what's your thought about that, Gary?
Well, good grief, we're back to dogfighting again, aren't we? But, I mean...
Cameron's got me going.
Again, I think this is another one where the saintly Vince Gable had it absolutely right.
Yeah, he was stitched up, wasn't he, by the Telegraph people?
He certainly was, and when he said he declared war on Rupert Murdoch, I think a few other people now want to join in the coalition against them.
And in The Guardian today, or tomorrow, actually, it's on Guardian Online, they're saying also that Danny Baker's BBC London show faces an axe as part of the station's cuts. That's not the Five Live one. He does on a Saturday, which I listen to from time to time. He's certainly a very good presenter, but cuts in local radio too. Is that a good idea?
Well, I don't think that the programmes that are most listened to, the morning and evening news, etc., and the specialist programmes, are likely to be cut. What they're talking about is the afternoon chat show is being amalgamated across two or three stations. I mean, I'm sure some people will be find that a loss. Personally, I won't.
They're also talking, though, about paring down of news and current affairs locally. So I suppose that will leave the field a little bit clearer for people like the Evening Post.
And us.
I think there'll be a long way to go before the Evening Post catch up with the local radio in terms of reporting.
Now, on to a subject which is very close to your heart, Gary. The smaller black bins, as a new firm takes over, Bristol City Council will start taking away residents' black rubbish bins and replacing them with smaller ones from next year. Although the council's already said it would cut down bin size by a quarter, until now it's only happened when old bins are replaced. But between January and June, the authority will start replacing all the 240-litre bins with 180-litre bins. So that's two-thirds of the old size. Now, we're already...
Well, three-quarters, actually. But
is it roughly? Okay. Thank you for your mental arithmetic. It's far better than mine. But ultimately, we're still facing two weekly bin collections. And for many, many parts of the city, you go around there and you find that the 240-litre bins are overflowing.
Very, very few indeed, in actual fact. The Bristolians have responded very well to the environmental agenda. And it was only last Friday that Mr Pickles, the glorious Secretary of State, or whatever he's called, made a complete fool of himself by actually saying that he dug out £250 million from behind the ministerial sofa that he was going to make available to councils if they promised to go back to residual weekly bin collections. In actual fact, we do weekly collections, but only of segregated waste, and that's the way that it is, and that's the way that it's actually going to stay. When we're all squeezed for cash, for Mr Pickles to think that's a priority is absolutely laughable, but dangerous as well at the same time, because it would have forced local taxpayers to stump up four and five times as much as he was prepared to put in.
So you're going to take all these old bins, put them in a mincing machine, and produce a whole load of new smaller ones?
In some cases, yes. In actual fact, some people will retain larger bins if they've got big families, that sort of thing. So the size of the bin will be relative to the size of the family that people will. Some because larger families need larger bins. What is not really mentioned at the front of that story is the actual fact that we're now going to be collecting plastic and Tetra Paks on the doorstep, which take up a very large volume in people's bins. And we will be providing an extra service on that and an extra facility on, for an extra recycling bin. So in actual fact, people will have more capacity. It's just that more of it will be in recycling facilities rather than residual bins.
So we've got all sorts of bins now, haven't we? We've got a sort of normal bin for everything else. We've got a bin for paper and another glass and, yeah. And also a separate one for plastic and another one for rotting food waste.
Well, it isn't rotting because it's removed fairly quickly. And apparently government policy now, according to Mr Pickles and all these tens of millions of pounds are going to follow it, is could the council, all councils should provide a facility for removing a leftover chicken tikka masala. Well, we're going to be writing to him to say that we want our share of that money that he's now found down the back of the sofa, because we do actually provide a facility for that to be taken away every week. The waste food, the containers, everything can disappear every week from people's homes, so there is no need for his residual collection every week.
So can you tell us why you went over to this contract to May Gurney rather than Sitter? What was the big advantage of May Gurney?
Well, the Sitter contract was at an end, so we were tendering. It was a process that had taken about a year and a half of what's called competitive dialogue, so not just haggling about price, but looking in a lot of detail at the quality of the services actually provided. The new contract is £2.5 million a year cheaper than the old contract, which is very, very welcome. But it also has some of the extra features, like the plastic collection.
And so this all starts beginning of next year, does it?
Well, the changes start at the end of beginning of next year. The contract changes over at beginning of November. A few day changes will actually take place end of November, but then the new plastic collection services, etc., will start beginning of next year.
Martin, what are your thoughts about this this story? Do you think it makes sense to actually get smaller and smaller bins? Because, as I said before, Gary, and I stand by it, you go around St Paul's sometimes, certainly by the time it comes to the end of the two-week period with bin collections, they're overflowing. People are putting, also trying to cram stuff into neighbours' bins because they've got no room left.
Well, I'm not an expert on waste. I mean, I think that there's obviously a lot of issues to be grappled with when you're making these kind of contracts. I think it's ridiculous of Pickles to just come up with something from... they're talking about decentralising power to local government, and then he's basically saying, I want to override that for some populist reason, because we've got the Tory Party conference this week. Yes, we're going to have weekly bin collection. I mean, these people are supposed to be running the country. They seem to be working out on the back of a fact packet.
Another story this week.
And what was amusing was that all my Tory counterparts in the area joined in and supported me when I called Mr. Pickles a buffoon.
Well, he's getting a reputation for it, isn't he?
Fears that the UK is in the worst ever economic crisis. This is the Sky News economics editor today. And also, some of the things that illustrate this is that Tesco has revealed its worst performance in 20 years this week. British supermarket Tesco has reported its worst performance in 20 years, another fall in sales and half-yearly results. Like-for-like sales, excluding VAT and petrol, declined by 0.5% in the UK for the first half of this year. And also, Premier Foods, the shares that collapse, warns on full year profits. This is a company shares in Premier Foods, maker of Branston Pickle, Bisto Gravy, Hovis Bread, slumped after it warned it would miss profit expectations. Now, this is certainly the first time as part of this recession, Gary, that we've seen the food giants we thought were sort of unstoppable, like Tesco's and Premier Foods, saying, sorry guys, we've just not been able to deliver the goods.
Well, one thing that isn't in that report is that Tesco, despite their like-for-like sales going down, their profits actually went up, which is a bit of an indication as to what happens when large private organisations get a stranglehold on a market.
That's right. That's absolutely right. But I think what all of these stats show, they're straws in the wind, that we're on the brink of what we've been calling a double-dip recession for the last 4 years, but it's not going to be... A double-dip recession sounds rather comforting. It means, we're not going to be as well off as we thought we were. We're going to have a bit of a double-dip. The real danger is that there's going to be a banking collapse. That's the danger. And I hope the top civil servants in Britain, the Eurozone and the United States have got a plan B for when the banks go down. because that will have to be brought into.
But
action.
What about this whole thing of the recession moving into the food retail sector here? And actually, this is a wholesaler. Yeah, Premier Foods is making food.
What you find in recessions, depressions, is that people trade down. So that
what does that mean?
Well, basically,
they go to Lidl instead of Tesco.
Yeah, they go to Lidl instead of Tesco's, and the people who used to shop in Sainsbury's and Waitrose go to Tesco. So there's all as Gary says, if the market is actually dominated by by oligopolistic firms, they're able basically to survive and make profits under any circumstances because the competition, basically competition doesn't really function for them. They're large enough to make their own prices and to make their own destiny, as it were.
But that's not
a long term reform that's required for things.
That's not really, Gary. That's not really market capitalism, is it? If they can just set their own price and people have to pay because it's food.
Well, it's a reality of market capitalism.
That's how it actually works.
All private organisations, private companies strive to dominate their market, maximise their profit margin. That's what they're there for. It's the job of governments to actually adjust that so that it works in the public interest rather than just the shareholder interest.
Okay, next story. The Forces helicopter, this is Avon and Somerset Police Forces helicopter, could be moved from the city. The relocation of the Avon and Somerset Police helicopter away from Bristol is one step closer to the police authority as agreed in principle to sign up to the National Police Air Service next year, which would see the force share resources from a base most likely to be in Wiltshire. Avon and Somerset helicopter, now based at Filton Airfield, could be based in Wiltshire at RAF Culloden, we're told. Now, Gary, this is a bit silly, isn't it? Because how long is it going to take to get from Culloden to the city?
Well, I mean, it's one of these schemes. It's almost as mad as the previous government scheme in terms of, fire control centres.
I mean, it's on the far side of Bath, Culloden, isn't it? It's probably about as far as Bath and there again.
Doing it because you'll waste an awful lot of time in them coming backwards and forwards to Bristol. In actual fact, it's the idea that by centralising everything you save money, and quite often you don't. And I don't think this is a sensible move at all. It needs to be looked at again. It does would actually make more sense if there's more cooperation between local agencies in terms of expensive facilities like helicopters, so that you've got multi-use out of them within the area.
Martin, do you think there's a sort of element of pressure from the current owners of Filton who are trying to wind things down there in this?
Well, I've no idea what's going on behind the scenes, but if you're going to have a helicopter in this region, surely the place to base it is Bristol, because that's where you're most likely to have your riots and what have you, isn't it? They're not going to be happening in Wiltshire, are they?
Okay, another story from the Evening Post this week. Elderly will be left to wither if the centre closes in Hotwells. Pensioners apparently will be left to wither when a day centre is forced to close due to funding cuts, it's been claimed. Trinity Day Centre in Hotwells helps 60 elderly people from Bristol have a better quality of life, offering them everything from activities to taking them shopping. But on October the 31st, the centre will shut after the council decided to pool £83,000 it needs each year to keep going. Manager Mark Griffiths accused the council of neglecting its citizens and turning its back on them. Mr. Griffiths, who joined the centre 16 years ago as a volunteer, said the council's short-sighted in not recognising the preventative care that the centre provides. Well, Gary, I think you better answer this one.
Well, social service is not my specialist area, but I do know that there's been a review of a lot of the centres and facilities, and some centres and facilities have had funding increased and others have not. And it was done on the basis of the service that was actually being provided compared to the money that was being inputted. The same goes for the lunch clubs, which are a very valuable resource. Some of them demand a huge subsidy for each person that they're looking after. Some of them seem to manage to do it for practically nothing.
Martin.
Yeah, well, I think underlying this is a move towards a personalisation. I mean, it says here elderly people are assessed by the councils as their needs and then funded through a personal budget of about £100 a week. So the philosophy underlying a lot of these changes, not just in Bristol but elsewhere, is that, the customers, as they seem to be conceived, will spend their own money. And as a friend of mine who works with adults with learning difficulties, and he's already branched out to set up his own business, as it were. He used to work in a day centre, and he's now providing trips out for the day, funded by his clients, as it were, who were his former people who used to go to the day centre. And I think for people with learning difficulties, that might be a viable strategy. But don't forget that a lot of elderly people are not in a position to spend their budgets in the way that's being suggested. I mean, a lot of people, I was at a meeting about this the other night, people from Trinity were saying that a lot of the resident, the people who use their day centre have got Alzheimer's. They don't understand what's going on. They just feel that they're losing. And basically, the fact that they come in every day to a centre gives them a social life, which they would not have if they got a personal budget and all the rest of it.
But Gary, can you see why some of the most vulnerable people in the city see this as a stab in the back?
Well, I think it's as just been said, the choice actually lies with the customer to a large extent, and I think one of the key things that council's actually got to do is to try and provide advice to those people to help them to get the best for their money. We're not in a position of saying you must go here, which is what's happened with some of the council facilities in the past. We block funded a centre and effectively told people that's the one you've got to use, and there are severe disadvantages with that.
You put all your eggs in one basket.
Yeah, but at the same time, in more kind of homogenous societies like Japan, that's the way they do it. And of course, it means that everybody does get to muck in together in one place. There's a danger of fragmentation and a huge variety of different things being provided. I mean, how are you going to vet all the people that are looking after elderly folks, for example? Are they going to be trained? Are they going to know what to do in an emergency and so on?
Well, they are regulated and inspected, sometimes not as well as they should be.
Well, we all know about that, don't we?
OK, on to our last story. And cannabis plants worth £850,000 were seized as the police swooped on Bristol drug farms. More than 900 cannabis plants worth, as I said, more than £850,000 were seized. Officers uncovered the drugs during 10 searches carried out in the first week of a sustained crackdown on gangs who grow the Class B drug. Largest haul during 10 successful raids so far in Operation Viking was in Glendale Down End, where 491 plants were seized and two Vietnamese were arrested. Other successful raids were carried out in Southwood Drive Sea Mills, where they found 30 plants, Cambridge Street Totterdown 50 plants, Bradley Road Patchway 46 plants, Mendip Road Western Supermare 162 plants, Severn Road in Western also with 85 plants. So it seems like there's cannabis sort of being grown all over the place. Gary, what are your thoughts about the priorities that the police have got here, and are you glad about these to see these raids taking place?
Well, it's a duty that the police have actually been landed upon them, basically, with present drug policies. They've got no choice.
Martin?
Yeah, I'd just like to, as I've said, we've had several Liberals on here over the last few weeks, and I'd just like to commend them yet again for their vote at their conference to discuss the legalisation of drugs. Very brave position. They're not going to get a lot of support from the Tory press for that. And in the Labour Party, when it was suggested that we should have a debate about it, Ed Miliband slapped it down, which I was very disappointed
in.
Ultimately, the drugs industry is a major issue that's got to be confronted. Don't forget that the private banks sucked in a lot of dirty money in 2008. There's a report from the UN Office on Drugs and Crime which says that what happened in 2008 as the banks wobbled is all the dirty money was sucked into the banks in one go.
But David Nutt from Bristol University was actually kicked out of the government's advisory committee on drugs for protesting about this and saying, what he was saying basically was that cannabis shouldn't be the priority, crack and heroin should be the priority.
Well, the point is the money, the dirty money involved. We've got, it's basically Vietnamese gangs doing this because there's a gap in the market and they've spotted it. Now, the fact of the matter is that that's the way the market works. And until we get our heads around this, that there is actually a drugs market, and it's a very important market, and a lot of money goes into it, then we will fail to get to grasp the problem. Ultimately, it's the money. Think of all the dirty money involved in Mexico, in Colombia. I mean, this is relatively small-scale local production. It's actually relatively harmless compared to what's going on.
Gary, what are your thoughts about ultimately whether or not all drugs should be criminalised, and also the priority of which drugs should be the police should be acting against and which maybe should be lower down the priority list?
Well, as I say, the police don't have any choice, and with the way that the law actually is at the moment, they must spend time and effort in dealing with this. And the problem is that they know that as well as any potential physical harm that this cannabis could actually cause, the money that's raised from it is, you know, the people who are involved in this are also involved in quite a number of other crimes as well. And it's quite surprising how often when they do this sort of stuff, these operations, what else it actually leads to. I think the point is that a lot of the problem with drugs, it's a health problem. And some drugs are far more serious and damaging from a health point of view than others. And until that's actually recognised and acted upon, then I think we're going to have a permanent firefighting situation.
Now, I'm reminded of last week when we discussed the possibility of you, personally, I don't know if your ears were burning last week, being one of the people potentially standing to be a police commissioner, because this is certainly the way things seem to be going, with elections potentially anyway next year, to actually get one individual to hold the police to account rather than the committee. What are your thoughts, first of all, though, on that whole idea of going from a police authority to an individual commissioner, the US system?
I'm not in favour of it at all. At the moment, the police authority does have disadvantages. It can be a bit woolly in certain areas, but it does at least actually reflect a range of political views, a range of geographical issues on the police authority. If you get one person in there, potentially a redneck, then you could have all sorts of difficulties. So I'm very much against the principle of it.
Okay, thanks very much to this week's guest, Lib Dem councillor for Knowle and Cabinet Executive Member for Waste, Gary Hopkins, and also to Martin Summers. After the news, the biggest changes in 60 years to planning.
BCFM.org.uk. BCFM News.